The archer reached down to pull another arrow out of his quiver. Blood trickled from the calluses torn off his hand, and he winced in pain as his aching fingers closed around the shaft. He knocked the arrow and flexed the tired muscles of his arms, shoulders, and back to draw the string, feeling the wood and horn of the composite bow flex with the strain. There was his target, a man standing on the battlements of the city wall just ahead, his head and shoulders pointing out above the mud brick as he aimed his own bow downward at the Assyrian soldiers approaching the defenses. He'd pay for that view, the archer thought, grinding his teeth in concentration and breathing in deeply to brace for the shot, his nostrils flaring at the acrid tang of smoke and burning coming from the besieged city. The bowstring snapped and the arrow flew straight and true. He watched the defender clutch at the shaft sprouting from his neck, then fall downward, dead before he even hit the ground. Another arrow followed, then another, then another, then another. Some aimed carefully at a new target, and others loosed to discourage an eager defender, until the archer was shouting for another quiver of iron-tipped shafts. So were the hundreds of other archers lined up on either side of him, all of them picking their targets in the same way. Hundreds of arrows flew toward the walls, joined by the whistling stone bullets flung from slings, a vibrating susurration of noise filling the air, the projectiles conspiring to knock the defenders from their perches as the Assyrians came closer and closer. The first ladder hit the walls, followed by companions on either side moments later. Soldiers in conical helmets of iron and bronze, rising to a sharp point, climbed upward with spears, swords, and daggers clutched in their hands. The first man toppled off the ladder with a thrown spear clean through his body, taking a comrade down with him as he fell. More followed them, struck by stones and arrows and javelins hurled from the battlements, but their companions kept climbing. One made it over the top, then another, hacking and stabbing with their weapons. The defenders fought back, but too many of their blows clanged off the overlapping bronze plates of their armored vests or those distinctive Assyrian helmets. Iron spearheads and blades found vulnerable flesh, skilled hands withdrew them from their victims with a practiced twist, and the Assyrians moved on to the next target. It was over in a matter of minutes. Blood and viscera dripped from the Assyrians' weapons. Some of them began to collect trophies from the dead, ears, noses, fingers. Some of the living were herded into long lines of prisoners, soon to become slaves or forced laborers, but the soldiers simply killed those too young, too old, or too infirm on the spot. Other soldiers, acting on their king's orders, beheaded the corpses of the prominent dead and stacked them in a neat pile. Others had a different task, plundering the city's palace and its temples, making a particular effort to smash or carry off the statues of the gods that resided there. If these patron deities had once protected the ancient city, they had long since changed their minds. Some would be left to burn with the rest of the city and its people. Others would be taken to a new residence in an Assyrian city, Nineveh, or even sacred Ashur, where they might find more suitable offerings from more powerful worshippers. The city crumbled around the soldiers as they went about their grisly work. It wasn't their first time sacking a venerable and once powerful urban center, and it wouldn't be their last. Such was the price of rebellion. The Neo-Assyrian Empire struck fear into the hearts of all who opposed it, and for centuries, it reigned supreme over the entire ancient Near East. Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me today. When we think about the great empires of the ancient world, we usually think of Rome and Alexander the Great. If we look to the east, we'll think about China and Qin Shi Huangdi and the Han Dynasty. And if we take a bit more expansive view, we'll probably include Achaemenid Persia, the empire of Cyrus the Great and Xerxes. But long before any Roman general stepped foot in Anatolia or Syria, centuries before Alexander launched his campaign into the heart of Asia, hundreds of years before Cyrus the Great marched west from the Zagros Mountains of Iran to found the Achaemenid Empire, were the Assyrians. Today, the Assyrian Empire, technically the Neo-Assyrian Empire, has been almost forgotten. There are exceptions to that, of course. Those with a keen interest in early biblical history know the Assyrian Empire, and it remains important to the many ethnic Assyrians who still live in the Near East and in diaspora communities around the world. Now, that latter story, that of Assyrian identity, is a fascinating one, but it's not something we'll be covering here today. What's really striking to me is the extent to which the Neo-Assyrian Empire has been left out of this narrative of succeeding empires. That's because it was the first, and it laid the groundwork for all that followed in exceptionally important ways. The institutions, infrastructure, and most of all, the ideas about what an empire was and how it could work were all set down by the Neo-Assyrians. In the words of the Assyriologist Karen Radner, it was a pathfinder empire. Those who came after, Neo-Babylonians, Medes, Persians, Macedonians, Romans, Sassanid Persians, and Arabs, all built on the foundation the Neo-Assyrians had first created. During its heyday, from the mid-8th century BC to the mid-7th century BC, the Neo-Assyrian Empire had no peers, it had no true competitors. It was a world empire, stretching from the Caspian Sea to the cataracts of the Nile, from the Persian Gulf to what's today central Turkey. Assyria's armies marched out, razed cities, plundered territories, resettled entire ethnic groups, and carried off the defeated people's gods, making them subject to all-powerful Ashur, the patron deity of the empire. The Assyrians built massive imperial cities with towering walls and impressive monuments, a network of roads, a sophisticated bureaucratic apparatus, and armies equipped, for the first time, with iron weaponry and true horse-mounted cavalry. They kept track of everything, from tribute payments to the numbers of deported people to the precise quantities of those slain in battle or executed on the orders of the king. Assyria was a truly terrifying force, and its kings boasted about their blood-soaked and brutal deeds. For nearly three centuries, the Assyrians were the preeminent force in Western Asia, and for more than a century, they were the essentially unchallenged rulers of a peerless world empire. But the brutality and terror with which the Assyrians ruled left few subjects with much love for their rulers. When the end came, it was shockingly quick, bloody, and thorough, every bit as bloody and thorough as the Assyrians' conquests had been. Their cities were left in ruins, their temples destroyed, and their legacies not just overlooked, but actively forgotten. Except, however, the Neo-Babylonians, Medes, and Persians who came next didn't really forget. They followed in the Assyrian predecessors' footsteps, using their techniques of deportation and exemplary punishment, their roads, their record-keeping systems, and their ideas about what an empire was and how to run it. Even as their successors actively tried to burn the memory of Assyrian power from the record, it remained just below the surface for a very long time to come. For the next two episodes, we'll discuss the Neo-Assyrian Empire and try to understand it. I think this requires two different perspectives. Today, we'll take a more traditional viewpoint. We'll look at it from the inside out, looking from the imperial center toward the peripheries. This is the way empires are usually understood, as products of their rulers' will to power, emphasizing the glorious monuments of imperial capitals and royal palaces, the lists of conquered places and peoples. It's necessary because we have to grasp the chronology of Assyria's history, who its kings were, what they did, and how they imposed their rule on their subjects. But there's also an entirely different way of viewing the Neo-Assyrian Empire, from the outside in or the ground up, emphasizing the points of views of the conquered, the empire's subjects, and the provinces. And even closer to home, we can choose to look at rural landscapes and the farmers working the fields rather than at the aristocrats, generals, and kings in the great cities at the imperial core. That's more or less what we'll try to do next time. So, in the beginning, there was no Assyria. Instead, there was a city, Ashur. It sat on the west bank of the Tigris River in what is today northern Iraq, overlooking one of the few excellent fords on the river from the heights of a sandstone cliff. Ashur's location is essential to understanding its subsequent history. It's likely that the city was founded sometime in the early 3rd millennium BC, perhaps by people from further to the south in Mesopotamia, as an entrepot to supply desired trade goods from further north. Timber and metals flowed south into the heartland, the great cities like Ur and Kish and Uruk, from the wetter, more mountainous lands to the north. Ashur was perfectly placed to supply these goods, and trade would remain central to the city's existence for a very long time to come. For that reason, it's not surprising that Ashur was periodically integrated into the empires that rose around it over the subsequent centuries. The city was probably subject to Sargon of Akkad, the region's first empire builder, and then to the third dynasty of Ur before finally becoming independent again around 2025 BC. When we next hear of Ashur, it's not in the city itself, but a long, long way to the west, at the city of Kanesh in Anatolia, more than 1,000 kilometers, 600 miles away. Residents of Ashur set up a trading colony at Kanesh, and through a stroke of luck, we have enormous quantities of records relating to their mercantile activity, mostly dating to the decades between about 1900 and 1860 BC. These merchants from Ashur were doing big business, mostly in metals. They transported tin, one of the two key components of bronze, from what's now Iran to Kanesh in Anatolia, and brought back gold and silver. Kanesh wasn't the only merchant colony they had in Anatolia either. The traders from Ashur set up more than 30 of them and smaller trading posts in Anatolia alone, and they were major players in the Anatolian copper trade. They also dealt in fine textiles sourced from those cities of southern Mesopotamia, which they moved to both Anatolia and Iran in return for those key metals that they traded. The Assyrian merchants at Kanesh provide one of the very earliest examples of a merchant network, operating mostly on credit and trust in world history. Ashur itself wasn't a particularly important place during this period. The city was extremely rich thanks to its trading activities. It would have been a bustling place filled with donkeys, ox carts, ingots of tin, and bales of textiles. Its merchants built expensive houses, and the city's god, also named Ashur, benefited in his temple complex. But it was small, with somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 residents packed into an area of 55 hectares, about 135 acres. The city's kings didn't rule an extensive territory. They had no ambitions of conquest, so far as we can tell. It wasn't surprising that the subsequent era saw Ashur again incorporated into a series of larger states. First, the large but short-lived empire of Shamshi-Adad in northern Mesopotamia, then the Babylon-based state of Hammurabi, followed by a few centuries of existence as a small independent state before becoming subject to the powerful kingdom of Mitanni from about 1450 BC until around 1350. Only then did Ashur again become definitively independent, and for the first time, it became the center of a larger empire of its own, marking the fundamental transition from Ashur to Assyria. Mitanni, a kingdom comprised of Hurrian speakers but seemingly ruled by a line of kings with Indo-Aryan names who worshipped Indo-Aryan deities, had been around for centuries. Its collapse was sudden, and the Assyrians, formerly subjects of Mitanni, were the greatest beneficiaries of this rapid shift in circumstances. Almost immediately after Mitanni's troubles began, Assyrian kings began to send letters to the pharaoh in Egypt, essentially demanding entry into the great powers club of the late Bronze Age. Their actions matched their rhetoric. Much of Mitanni's former territory fell under the rule of Ashur. The term Assyrian, rather than referring to people from the city of Ashur, came to simply mean anyone living within a territory that acknowledged the god Ashur as its overlord. We'll come back to that overlap between god, city, and imperial authority later, but for now, suffice to say that the end of the 14th BC marks the beginning of Assyria as a territorial unit extending beyond the city itself. The Hittites, who had fought Mitanni for centuries, were the other major beneficiaries of the kingdom's decline, but the shift in circumstances simply meant a change in enemies. For the next century, down to the end of the Hittite kingdom and the Bronze Age collapse, Assyria slowly but surely chipped away at its Anatolian neighbor to the northwest. Assyria also flexed its muscles southwards, periodically fighting with and interfering in the affairs of Kassite Babylonia to the south. Throughout this time, Assyria retained its position as a key node on those east-west trade routes that moved metals, textiles, and luxury goods around the interconnected Late Bronze Age world. The core of the Hittite kingdom fell in the opening act of the Bronze Age collapse. Kassite Babylonia lasted a bit longer, but it too disintegrated in the middle of the 12th century BC. Egyptian rule over the Levant and part of Syria didn't survive long past that. Assyria didn't come through all of this completely unscathed. There were succession crises, perhaps famines, and conflicts with neighboring peoples. But by 1114 BC, when Tiglath-Pileser I took the throne of Assyria, it had become the dominant power in the region. Over a reign of nearly 40 years, Tiglath-Pileser's armies marched as far as the Mediterranean in the west and south into Babylonia, conquering large swaths of territory and winning major victories. But even at this seeming high point, all was not well. Aramean tribes in the west raided Assyrian territory, and the Assyrians were unable to exercise control to the south in Babylonia. The period from about 1050 BC to 950 BC is really poorly documented. Very few sources tell us what was happening. But it's clear that Assyria was in significant trouble. It wouldn't have been surprising if it too had gone under, like so many of the states of that period. But Assyria didn't collapse completely. Even at its weakest, Ashur seems to have maintained its control over a core territory in what's now northern Iraq. This territory took the shape of a rough triangle, the city at each corner. Ashur in the southeast, Nineveh, buried under the modern city of Mosul in the north, and Arbela, today's Erbil, in the northeast. From this base, a rich agricultural region that still controlled the major fords and thus the trade routes over the Tigris, the Assyrian kings once again set their sights on the world beyond.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
By the middle of the 10th century BC, practically all of the powerful, long-lived territorial states of the late Bronze Age world had disappeared. The Hittites, Mitanni, Kassite Babylonia, and the extended empire of New Kingdom Egypt were all gone. In their place, a variety of smaller political units had emerged, like the Neo-Hittite states of Syria and southern Anatolia, the Hebrew and Phoenician kingdoms of the Levant, and the ethnic tribal units of the Aramaeans scattered across the region. In Assyria, by contrast, the state structures of the prior era had mostly survived. More importantly, so too had the Assyrian kings' sense of their past as imperial rulers. It's not a coincidence that the blood-soaked conquerors of the Neo-Assyrian period largely bore the same names as their Middle Assyrian predecessors, like Adad-Nirari and Tukulti-Ninurta. This was a conscious reaching back to a memory of past greatness that they wanted to recapture. The key term there is recapture. For the Neo-Assyrian rulers, there was no meaningful distinction between what we call the Middle Assyrian period of the Late Bronze Age and their reconstituted empire in Neo-Assyrian times. And in fact, up until the reign of Tiglath-Pileser III in the mid-8th century, even the size and aspirations of the Neo-Assyrian empire strongly resembled those of its Middle Assyrian predecessor. What changed in the Iron Age was the context. When the Assyrians once more began to expand, they met little resistance of the kind the great powers of the Late Bronze Age might have provided. This dramatically changed world goes a long way toward explaining precisely how Assyria became the first world empire in the centuries to come. To be clear, this wasn't a one-way process of unceasing conquest and uninterrupted rise. It was much more punctuated, with two major phases of expansion separated by an 80-year period of fragmentation and internal conflict. Both of those phases of expansion were herky-jerky, with massively successful campaigns followed by long periods of consolidation. A quick note here, for much of the following, I'm drawing on the Assyriologist Eckhart Fromm's chapter in the edited volume A Companion to Assyria. When Ashurdan II took the throne in 934 BC, he inaugurated the first phase of Assyria's conquests close to home, in the lands bordering that core triangle in northern Iraq defined by Nineveh, Arbela, and Ashur itself. Ashurdan II was the first ruler of what we call the Neo-Assyrian period, and for him and the rulers who followed, they weren't building an empire from the ground up. Instead, they were simply liberating Assyrian lands and Assyrian peoples from the oppressors who had taken control during the preceding period of Assyrian weakness. The fact that this process of reconquest involved a great deal of spilled blood and the extraction of copious amounts of material and human plunder in no way conflicted with the idea that this all belonged to Assyria. To the god Ashur, properly speaking, anyway. Ashurdan II's best documented conquest was that of the small kingdom of Kathmuhu, on the eastern border of that core triangle. Kathmuhu had been subject to Assyria in ages past, but had at some point gained its independence. No longer. Ashurdan II stripped the royal palace of its valuables and then destroyed it, carrying off Kathmuhu's king as a prisoner to Arbela. The king was then flayed alive, and his skin was hung on a city wall as a warning. This kind of brutality became a hallmark of Assyrian empire building, make examples as bloodily as possible in order to crush resistance before it began. All of Ashur-dan II's campaigns took place in the immediate vicinity of that core triangle, but the reigns of his son and grandson steadily increased the scope of Assyrian ambitions. The armies, drawn from both the core lands and the vassal kingdoms subjugated to Assyria like Kathmuhu, marched further and further. Under Adad-nirari II, Ashur-dan II's son, Assyrian soldiers went southeast into Babylonian territory and then even further near the border of the Elamite state of southwestern Iran. These campaigns culminated in the transfer of a great deal of formerly Babylonian territory to Assyrian control. They also headed west toward the Euphrates River, fighting battles, subjugating small kingdoms, and collecting tribute from others that chose not to resist. Two things are notable about these initial forays. First, their geographic scope was pretty limited. It's not like Assyrian armies one day got up and headed for the limits of the known world. They were campaigning in territory that was no more than a couple of hundred miles at the very most from the core triangle of Assyrian land in northern Iraq. Second, the cities and kingdoms over which they exercised actual control were even more limited. Present-day Kirkuk was one of these, but it's only 50 miles, about 75 kilometers south of Erbil, one of the corners of the triangle. For the most part, the Assyrians simply ensured that a local elite loyal to them was in control and that tribute flowed regularly. They had little interest in direct annexation or the administrative headaches that process would involve, at least initially. This was part of the logic behind the Assyrians' use of exemplary brutality. If potential enemies were deathly afraid, they were more likely to send the required tribute without an occupying force. Things started to change with the accession of Ashur-nasirpal II in 883 BC. It was during Ashur-nasirpal's reign that Assyria changed dramatically from a substantial but limited regional power to the most powerful state in West Asia, a truly imperial power. Ashur-nasirpal campaigned ceaselessly throughout his 24-year reign. His armies went south and east into Babylonian territory, north toward the highlands of eastern Anatolia, and west toward the Euphrates in Syria. The Neo-Hittite kingdoms like Old Carchemish were subjugated. Eventually, Ashur-nasirpal reached the Mediterranean itself, and all of the small kingdoms of the coast, like the rising Phoenician cities of Tyre, Sidon, Arwad, and Byblos, paid massive tributes in silver and other precious metals in order to be left alone. But while Phoenicia escaped the wrath of Ashur-nasirpal II, other places within the Assyrian orbit weren't so lucky. When the city of Tela along the upper Tigris River revolted in 882, the second year of Ashur-nasirpal's reign, his response was brutal. In an inscription, something meant for public consumption, this is how he described his actions at Tela. Quote, "I captured many troops alive. From some, I cut off their arms and hands. From others, I cut off their noses, ears, and extremities. I hung their heads on trees around the city. I burnt their adolescent boys and girls. I razed, destroyed, burnt, and consumed the city." The message was clear, and examples of this kind of rhetoric abound throughout Ashur-nasirpal's reign and the Neo-Assyrian period as a whole. Ashur-nasirpal II was a destroyer on an epic scale, but he was also an ambitious builder. His greatest project was a new capital city, a place designed to impress all who saw it with the scale of Assyria's greatness. The result was the city of Kalyu, also known as Nimrud, which Ashur-nasirpal transformed into one of the greatest cities in the world through the application of imperial resources and coercion. Thousands upon thousands of conscripted laborers and captives taken in Ashur-nasirpal's incessant wars worked for years to build a massive palace complex and temples contained within a wall circuit stretching 5 miles, 7.5 kilometers. The images and sculptures decorating the palace and temples were incredible in quality and number, including enormous stone bulls and carefully carved reliefs depicting Assyrian military successes and piety to the gods. When the palace complex was completed in 864 BC, after 15 years of work, Ashur-nasirpal celebrated with a feast of epic proportions. 69,574 guests attended, consuming 10,000 skins of wine and 10,000 jugs of beer over the course of 10 days. Kalyu would serve as Assyria's capital for 150 years after Ashur-nasirpal's party, the political heart of a sprawling and powerful empire. By 800 BC, it had 75,000 permanent residents, and it was among the largest cities in the world. It's not clear precisely why Ashur-nasirpal invested so much time and resources in Kalyu, but it probably had something to do with the city's location, which was right in the middle of that core triangle area. The king was likely also trying to curb the power of the old Assyrian aristocracy by filling Kalyu with eunuchs, officials, and bureaucrats loyal only to the crown. Ashurnasirpal's son Shalmaneser succeeded him and continued the program of conquest. His major opponent was the rising kingdom of Urartu to the north, centered on the Lake Van region of eastern Anatolia. In one of the most impressive campaigns in Assyria's long history, Shalmaneser's army made a gigantic circuit, marching west toward the Euphrates, following it north to its headwaters in the mountains of what's now Turkey, then turning east and devastating the heart of Urartu before turning south and returning to Assyria. This was just the beginning. The Assyrians fought in the east in what's now Iran and in the south in Babylonia. Shalmaneser's armies went west over and over, besieging Damascus and Syria on multiple occasions and fighting to a draw with a coalition of western states that included a certain Ahab, king of a small kingdom called Israel. Eventually, Israel, under its king Jehu, became one of the many kingdoms to pay tribute to Shalmaneser. By the end of Shalmaneser's reign, however, it was obvious that Assyria had overextended itself. Urartu, seemingly cast down in one of Shalmaneser's first campaigns, came back with a vengeance. In 826 BC, 2 years before Shalmaneser's eventual demise, one of his sons, who had been passed over for the succession, rebelled in a serious civil war. This was a major issue. The son in question had the support of Nineveh and Ashur itself, along with a sizable portion of the Assyrian aristocracy. It took 6 years for the eventual winner, Shalmaneser's younger son, Shamshi-Adad V, to finally quell all of the internal dissension. But Shamshi-Adad's victory came at a price for royal authority. For the following 80 years, what Assyriologists often call the Age of the Magnates, power shifted away from the king and toward the highest members of the elite, generals and court officials who controlled huge tracts of land, whole provinces, and armies of their own. The fact that we know far less about the political history of this era is a direct reflection of the decline of royal power, since the kings weren't doing nearly as much worthy of being inscribed on monuments. Assyrian armies continued to march out to fight, especially toward the east in what's now Iran and north against Urartu, but their campaigns were directed by powerful military leaders and other magnates. At times, provincial governors seemed to have acted essentially on their own authority, barely or not at all mentioning the king. Some kings were minors, ciphers for regents of various stripes, while others were simply non-entities. Not a single royal inscription, for example, survives from the decade-long reign of Ashur-nirari V, only governor's inscriptions. The most serious threat came in the form of internal revolts. One lasted for 5 years between 763 and 758 BC, and another in 746 was probably what killed Ashur-nirari V. Assyria stood on the brink, weakened by decades of civil war and the decay of central authority. It wouldn't have been particularly surprising if the magnates took the various pieces of Assyrian territory in different directions, declaring themselves kings in their own right. But that didn't happen. The governor of Kalyu, who may have been Ashur-nirari V's brother or perhaps a son, or maybe just a total unknown, ascended the throne in uncertain circumstances. When he became king, this man took the name of Tiglath-Pileser III, a throwback to some of the greatest conquerors in Assyria's long and bloody history, and inaugurated a new era that saw Assyria reach its greatest heights.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
Tiglath-Pileser III took the throne of Assyria in 745 BC. He wasn't a young man at the time, he may have been 50 years old, and his claim to rule was probably pretty shaky. The sources disagree about who his father was, including those put forth by Tiglath-Pileser III himself, and the circumstances surrounding his accession are shadowy enough to conclude that he was probably the victor in a civil war. He may, in fact, have been responsible for Ashur-nirari V's death. We simply don't know. But what's clear is that once he became king, Tiglath-Pileser III didn't look back. He spent his entire reign campaigning and did so with stunning success. The age of the magnates was over and a new era of royal power had begun. Over the course of his 20 years on the throne, Tiglath-Pileser III sent Assyria's armies outward in literally every direction. The east, particularly the part of Iran we call Media, wasn't a priority, but it was still the target of at least two campaigns, Babylonia to the south was a much more important target. Only 5 months after becoming king, Tiglath-Pileser III made his first foray south, probably an extended raid intended to secure the position of an allied king on the Babylonian throne. His second expedition was much more extensive, leading to the conquests of a bunch of cities and Tiglath-Pileser's crowning as the legitimate king of Babylonia. Babylonia, basically the southern Mesopotamian heartland from north of Baghdad down to the Persian Gulf, was full of large and wealthy urban centers. The densely populated region was rich, fertile, and carried immense cultural prestige. For Tiglath-Pileser III to become Babylonia's king was a massive coup, and that was just one of his major victories. In the north, Tiglath-Pileser III crushed Urartu and its allies in a series of campaigns, one of which involved the siege of Urartu's capital. In the west, Tiglath-Pileser's successes were even more striking. He brought the middle portion of the Euphrates River firmly under Assyrian control, extracted tribute from the petty kingdoms of southern Syria and the Levant, including Israel and Judah. The Assyrians even captured Gaza and marched all the way to the Egyptian border, where Tiglath-Pileser erected a statue of himself to mark his presence. None of this was easy. Repeated campaigns were necessary to fully crush resistance, and Assyrian control was often tenuous. Yet, by the end of his reign, Tiglath-Pileser had effectively doubled the size of Assyria. He also dramatically changed the nature of the Assyrian state and its relationship with its subject territories. Instead of being content to extract tribute from effectively unbothered subordinate states like the small kingdoms of Syria or the city-states of Phoenicia, backed up with the threat of extreme violence, Tiglath-Pileser instead opted for more direct control. He divided up conquered lands into provinces, which then received an Assyrian governor who levied regular taxes. It was more expensive and difficult to administer provinces than to simply receive tribute and gifts from allies, which the Assyrians still did. But taxation, rather than forcible extraction, meant that Assyrian soldiers could be put to use further and further away from home. The armies didn't have to spend every other campaign reasserting control over a rebellious vassal near the Assyrian core area. Taxation freed up immense amounts of resources to provide for the armies even on extremely distant campaigns. Assyria already had a standing army rather than a temporary conscript force, one that was usually divided into forces kept in the various border regions, but now its reach was far longer. Another key change under Tiglath-Pileser III was the massively increased use of deportations. The Assyrians had been bringing war captives and forced laborers to the Assyrian heartland for centuries. That was largely who had built the new capital at Kalyu between 879 and 864 BC, after all. But Tiglath-Pileser III used deportations as a fundamental tool of imperial policy, one aimed at snuffing out resistance before it could begin. At least tens of thousands of people, and probably more like hundreds of thousands, were moved en masse from province to province of the Assyrian Empire during Tiglath-Pileser's reign. The total would come to somewhere in the realm of 1.5 million deportees in the next century and a half. Now, to be clear, these weren't the genocidal forced marches of the 20th century. As the Assyriologist Karen Radner points out, the Assyrians highly valued the deportees and their labor, and they wanted them to reach their new home so that they could be put to productive use. In fact, a common theme in the source texts depicts the deportees as precious trees, uprooted and transplanted by a conscientious gardener, the Assyrian king. Assyrian art frequently depicts these forced movements, and the deportees are never shown in restraints or as victims of violence, unlike the often gruesome images of the conquered and slain we see when it comes to war. The deportees were put to use in high-value agricultural pursuits, such as flax, olive oil, fruit, and wine processing, using the most advanced available techniques. These forced movements were a source of fantastic agricultural productivity for the Assyrians, but this was only half the goal. The other, probably more important piece, relied on deportations to create a homogeneous imperial citizenry, Assyrians, out of an incredibly diverse mosaic of subject peoples. We'll talk more about forced movements in our second episode on Assyria. Assyria's frontiers continued to expand throughout the rest of the 8th century BC, particularly under the powerful ruler Sargon II, named after the famous Akkadian ruler who had lived some 1,500 years earlier. Sargon's armies campaigned in Syria to reestablish control after his accession, to the east against the Medes of what's now Iran, and south in Babylonia. A massive rebellion in southern Syria and the Levant led to a round of deportations from Samaria. In conjunction with Tiglath-Pileser's deportations in 732 BC, this is the source of the legend of the Lost Tribes of Israel. Once again, the Assyrians marched as far as the border of Egypt, where they defeated an Egyptian army before exacting tribute from the ruler of Lower Egypt. But the most significant campaigns were in the north. Like his predecessors, Sargon fought against Urartu, but he also faced a new enemy, a king called Mita, who ruled a people called the Mushku, or Phrygians. To the Greeks, Mita was Midas, and we know him because of his supposed golden touch. Anatolia occupied a great deal of Sargon II's time and energy, and it was there in 705 BC that he met his end. The king was seized by the soldiers of a ruler named Gordius and killed, and the Assyrians were unable to recover his body. Sargon's successor, his son Sennacherib, immediately abandoned Sargon's magnificent new capital, a city built from scratch called Dur-Sharrukin in favor of Nineveh. He never mentioned his father in inscriptions and generally took the opposite tack in his policies whenever possible. It's telling that one of his first acts as king, as Eckhart Fromm points out, was to restore a temple of the underworld god Nergal in an attempt to pacify him after Sargon II's violent death. Sennacherib was a builder, and his accomplishments survive today in the form of the spectacular remains of the city of Nineveh. He named Nineveh his capital and completely rebuilt the city, adding a 12-kilometer or 8-mile-long city wall studded with gates. This wall stood 25 meters, 82 feet tall. The other major feature was a palace covering 40,000 square meters, some 430,000 square feet. It's possible that the gardens included in this palace were the inspiration for the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the wonders of the ancient world. But Sennacherib was also a conqueror on an epic scale. He's best known for his campaign to the kingdom of Judah in 701 BC, an event described in several places in the Bible, which ended in the subjugation of Judah and its king Hezekiah and a major deportation. In the context of the age, however, what Sennacherib did in the south was far more significant. Assyrian kings had periodically fought with the state of Elam, located in southwestern Iran around Susa, for centuries. Elam had often been formally allied with, or at least supportive of, Babylonia in its off-and-on conflicts with Assyria. Under Sennacherib, these off-and-on conflicts turned into war on an epic scale. The result was the tragic sacking and destruction of Babylon itself in 689 BC, which razed large sections of the city and included the plundering of numerous statues of the gods that had resided in the city. This was a really, really big deal. Statues weren't just representations of the gods, but the gods themselves, and destroying or carting them off was an incredible act of sacrilege. The consequences of these acts would take decades to manifest, but when they did, they were extreme. Sennacherib, quite fittingly, met his demise sooner. 8 years after Babylon fell, he was murdered at a temple in Nineveh by one of his sons, whom he'd passed over for the succession in favor of a younger one, Esarhaddon. Esarhaddon still managed to defeat his brother and take the throne in 681 BC. And during his 12-year reign, Assyria ascended toward its peak as a world empire. Esarhaddon was an unpleasant, sickly, and suspicious man, though perhaps with good reason. His reign was filled with conspiracies and attempted coups even at the heart of Assyria, and in 670 he had numerous high officials executed for their part, real or imagined, in plots to overthrow him. The key event of Esarhaddon's reign, however, was in the southwest. The rulers of Egypt, the Nubian pharaohs of the 25th dynasty, had been attempting to extend their influence into the Levant, Phoenicia, Palestine, and southern Syria for quite some time. Basically, they wanted to recreate the empire of New Kingdom Egypt. Esarhaddon naturally considered that to be a serious territory, and he responded with not one but two invasions of Egypt. The first in 674 failed, the second in 671 did not. The Assyrians sacked the Egyptian capital of Memphis and, in a pretty standard move, placed loyal local rulers in power to maintain their control over Lower Egypt. But this didn't last, and it was on the way to quell a rebellion that Esarhaddon died in 669 BC. It was left to Esarhaddon's son and heir, Ashurbanipal, to cement Assyria's control over Egypt in the course of two successful campaigns. The second of these, in 663 BC, culminated in the sack of Thebes, the ancient and impossibly wealthy capital of Upper Egypt. The 25th dynasty was expelled from Egypt for good, and the Assyrians carried off immense quantities of plunder. Here's how one Assyrian text written from Ashurbanipal's perspective paints these events. "The city, the whole of it, I conquered with the help of Ashur and Ishtar. Silver, gold, precious stones, all the wealth of the palace, rich cloth, precious linen, great horses, supervising men and women, two obelisks of splendid electrum weighing 2,500 talents, it's about 75 tons. The doors of temples I tore from their bases and carried them off to Assyria. With this weighty booty I left Thebes. Against Egypt and Cush I have lifted my spear and shown my power. With full hands I have returned to Nineveh in good health." At this point, in 663, Assyria had reached its greatest extent. from the cataracts of the Nile in the south to the Caspian Sea, from the highlands of central Anatolia, today's Turkey, to the Persian Gulf. No state in history had ever been larger, wealthier, or more militarily potent. But nothing could last forever. Ashurbanipal is widely considered one of the greatest of Assyria's kings, and he spent the vast majority of his reign embroiled in one conflict after another. These were successful in the short run. A siege of the Phoenician city of Tyre on the Mediterranean led to its submission and tribute was paid, for example. But in the long run, Ashurbanipal's reign marked the beginning of the end. Assyrian control over Egypt didn't last. By 656 BC, just 7 years after the sack of Thebes, the ruler of Egypt, Psamtik, had thrown off Assyrian vassalage and ruled the entire country independently. Armies were forced to rush from one hotspot to the next, and the frontiers facing toward Anatolia in the northwest, Urartu in the north, and western Iran in the northeast were under constant pressure. The greatest threats, however, came in the south. Esarhaddon, Ashurbanipal's father and predecessor, had two sons. Obviously, Ashurbanipal became the king of Assyria, but the other, Shamash-shum-ukin, Esarhaddon made king of Babylonia. The relationship between the two brothers was strained, just as the relationship between Babylonia and Assyria had been strained for many centuries. And Shamash-shum-ukin was ambitious and determined to turn Babylonia into a genuine power. It was only a matter of time until open war broke out. And when it did, the conflict involved not just Babylonia and Assyria, but also the powerful Iranian state of Elam, whose king had a long and contentious relationship with Ashurbanipal. The Assyrian king utterly crushed the Elamites first, describing his actions like this. Quote, "Like the onset of a terrible hurricane, I overwhelmed Elam in its entirety. I cut off the head of Teuman, their king, the haughty one who plotted evil. Countless of his warriors I slew. Alive with my hands, I seized his fighters. With their corpses, I filled the plain about Susa, as with Baltu and Ashigu." Those are two kinds of desert shrubs. "Their blood I let run down the Ulai." That's a river in Susa. "Its water I dyed red like wool." The war with Shamash-shum-ukin and Babylonia dragged on for years, including a long siege of Babylon itself and a series of engagements across the region. In the end, Babylon fell in an orgy of bloodletting, which one source describes in these words. "Their carved-up bodies I fed to dogs, to pigs, to wolves, to eagles, to birds of the heavens, to fishes of the deep." Shamash-shum-ukin died in the sack and is traditionally thought to have burned alive in his palace in the city. Ashurbanipal followed this with a brutal invasion of Elam itself, sacking city after city before taking their capital of Susa. In Susa, the Assyrians plundered and smashed with even more than their usual enthusiasm. The invading armies destroyed the city's ziggurat, looted its temples of their sacred statues, razed the royal tombs, and carried off the ancient bones to Assyria. They cut down sacred groves of trees, and they even salted the earth so that nothing would grow. The Assyrian inscriptions describe the devastation in excruciating detail, perhaps with the intent of sending the message that Elam had forever been wiped off the earth as a viable state. By 640 BC, when the sources for Ashurbanipal's reign become much scantier and harder to interpret, Assyria seemed to be at the very peak of its powers. In just two decades, its armies had destroyed three of the great cities of the ancient world and defeated every foe in open battle. Ashurbanipal had assembled the world's first universal library and ordered the creation of stunning works of art in his capital, Nineveh, that still capture our imagination today. But the end was coming, and it was coming faster than anyone could imagine. Next time on Tides of History, we'll cover the shocking fall of Assyria, how its past sins literally came home to roost. But we'll also dig deeper into what it meant to live in Assyria's empire, to be subject to these blood-soaked conquerors, and to live in the world they had created. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. I've also written a book called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, paperback, ebook, or audiobook that I read, of course, from your distributor of choice. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman, sound design by Derek Behrens for Airship, audio editing by Molly Bach for Airship. Sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect.